airstrike on the Lebanese capital, Beirut. In a statement, the movement said At-Tabatabai was martyred in Israel's treacherous strike on the Harat Harek district in Beirut's southern suburbs. It described him as a committed commander whose sacrifice inspired the resistance with hope, resolve and strength in its battle against the enemy. Hezbollah stressed that following his martyrdom, resistance fighters will move forward with steadfastness and courage to defeat all projects of the Zionist enemy and its main supporter, the United States. Israel's attack on Beirut killed at least 5 people and wounded 20 others. The strike marks another flagrant violation of the ceasefire agreement signed between the regime and Lebanon a year ago. Israel has carried out near daily attacks on southern Lebanon since then. However, this is the first time in months that Beirut has come under attack. Our Beirut correspondent Mariam Saleh joined us earlier with more details on the martyrdom of Hezbollah's senior commander. Let's see what she had to say.
We learned from the statement of Hezbollah that one of the martyrs was Haj Haytham Tabatabai, and he is considered the leader of the military resistance, of the armed resistance in Hezbollah. And he was martyred along with 4 others of his comrades, as we learned, who were in that apartment building. Now, we know from some sources that, of course, the wounded are civilians. And, of course, we know that this is an area that was a residential area, which is with apartment buildings and so on. And there are definitely a lot of civilians that were struck, in addition to the fact that we have damages on the civilian level and many cars that were damaged and so on. We have a statement out, as you mentioned, from Hezbollah confirming the martyrdom of Sayyid Haytham Tabatabai. And we also know from his history, of course, he was one of the first or the pioneers of the resistance in Lebanon. He was someone who took part in operations, military operations in the war of attrition forced by the resistance against the Israeli occupation forces during the occupation before the year 2000. After the year 2000, also he was the commander, basically in most areas in the south, especially in the area of Khiyam.
Israel has struck a residential building in the heart of the Beirut suburbs. The 3rd and 4th floors of a 9-story building were badly damaged, with debris filling the road, damaging cars and property. A senior commander was targeted in the strike.
This is an attempted assassination, targeting a key leader within the resistance. What matters now is that we document this as a clear act of aggression, an escalation we cannot and will not tolerate. It is our responsibility at the national level to establish a response that confronts Israel's attempt to undermine our sovereignty.
Although the Israeli statement said the target was a commander in the resistance, people near the scene say Israeli strikes are targeting everyone.
I am from this neighborhood. Every time they come up with this claim that they are targeting a member of the resistance, we are all members of the resistance. I want to tell our prime minister, who was a judge in the international court, if your diplomacy can't protect us and solve our crisis, then leave us to be and don't speak in our name. And this mechanism is obviously biased towards Israel.
Alice believes the Israeli claims that Hezbollah has rehabilitated is merely preparing the ground for a larger escalation and a U.S. green light for this aggression.
This marks a new level of violation, and there are 2 potential outcomes. Either the resistance retaliates, which would escalate into a full-scale war, or they absorb this blow, which could embolden Israel to carry out further strikes. Both options are devastating. This is a turning point. With Israel seeking to normalize its escalation in Lebanon, backed by U.S. support, and with the Lebanese government failing to take action.
President Joseph Aoun called on the international community to intervene firmly to stop Israeli attacks on the country. Lebanon, he said, reiterates its call to the international community to assume its responsibility and intervene firmly and seriously to stop the attacks on Lebanon and its people. The Israeli strike on the southern suburbs of Beirut and the U.S. blessing are considered part of the growing pressure by both sides to enforce full surrender by Hezbollah and full compliance of the Lebanese government to disarm the resistance. However, many believe that this opens the way for different scenarios, especially if the resistance decides it is time to retaliate. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
Israel's assassination of a top Hezbollah commander in Lebanon has sparked a strong wave of condemnations from regional countries and resistance movements. Iran's foreign ministry strongly condemned Israel's, quote, cowardly assassination of Haytham Ali Atabatabai in an attack on a residential area of Beirut. The ministry said the strike was a savage assault on Lebanon's sovereignty and national integrity and a blatant violation of the country's ceasefire deal with Israel. It also slammed the inaction of the UN and the UN Security Council on Israel's frequent crimes against Lebanon, urging immediate international action to stop the regime's terrorism. Earlier, the deputy head of Hezbollah's political council, Mahmoud Ghamati, said the assassination will escalate violence across Lebanon. Lebanon's president, Joseph Aoun, called the strike a clear sign of Israel's disregard for repeated international appeals to halt its assaults. Hamas condemned the attack as a cowardly act of aggression aimed at dragging the region into a wider war, while Yemen's Ansarullah movement denounced the strike as a blatant violation of international humanitarian law. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad also slammed the attack as a war crime. Political analyst Firas Al-Najim joined us earlier to discuss the reactions shown to the latest Israeli crime in Lebanon in more detail.
If you look at the statements from the people on the ground, just the normal civilians on the ground, and you can see that most of the people are in support of the resistance, and they are standing firmly with the resistance, and they're saying that nothing will install fear in the nation of Lebanon, especially with such great leadership such as Haytham al-Tabtabai, or Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, or Sayyid Hashim Safi al-Din, or all the great martyrs like Imad Mughniya, and the list goes on. Of all these great sacrifices that are all towards supporting the oppressed people of Palestine. And this is an honorable history, an honorable stand that will always be recorded in support of the people that need the most assistance, and that is the Palestinian people. And we've seen in these last years suffering and the suffocation of the Palestinian people and the disregard to human life. And this only makes the people more firm in their battle against this enemy, and how this enemy has no borderlines and has no true rules, and no respect for international law or any human rights groups or any human rights organizations or the United Nations whatsoever. And even the ceasefire that was brokered between Lebanon and the Zionist entity through a mediator, and that is the U.S., obviously the main culprit and the main supporter of all these crimes in this Zionist entity, they're not respecting that ceasefire agreement at all.
Gaza's government media office strongly condemns the Israeli violations of the U.S.-brokered Gaza ceasefire, reporting nearly 500 breaches in just 44 days. The office said these violations constitute a flagrant breach of international humanitarian law and the humanitarian protocol attached to the agreement. It stated that since the ceasefire came into effect, over 340 Palestinians have been killed in the regime's attacks, with children, women, and the elderly making up the majority of the victims. The office also reported that amongst these violations, more than two dozen occurred on Saturday, resulting in over 20 Palestinian deaths and nearly 90 casualties.
We felt relieved during this period and thought it was a truce and we felt safe. But then, suddenly, two missiles fell, killing 13 or 14 people from my family in addition to the injuries and amputations, for people were wounded. Why? No one knows.
They were safe and secure, believing the war was over. But suddenly, a missile from the occupation struck, killing them all. Only the daughter and the father, who is in intensive care, survived. My message is that we want to live in peace and security, and we are tired of the killings, death, displacement, and losing our loved ones.
Meanwhile, hospitals in Gaza are running out of essential supplies, with stocks of gauze, antiseptics, thermometers, and antibiotics running low due to Israel's intensified attacks. The director of nursing at Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis said there is little difference from the period before the ceasefire. Mohammed Sakr warned that there are daily crises and staff remains exhausted as they continue to receive many, many casualties. Our Gaza correspondent Moti Abu Musabbeh joined us earlier with the latest updates on Israel's repeated ceasefire violations across the war-torn territory. Let's see what he had to say.
A short while ago, the Israeli occupation forces renewed their artillery strikes against the eastern part of Al-Burij refugee camp, coupled with the intense mass shooting and gunfire towards those areas. And in addition to that, the Israeli occupation forces also continue to detonate more residential buildings in the eastern side of Khan Yunis city. And as you know, the current situation is still intense. And as you know, those attacks are still intense in the eastern side of Gaza city as well, which is still witnessing more full attacks by the Israeli artillery. In addition to that, the Israeli forces also proceeded to detonate further residential buildings in that area. So we are still witnessing this surge and uptick of those plural attacks against the Palestinian people, and those attacks are still inflicting more death and destruction in those areas, and the Palestinian people are still devastated by the continuous and the ongoing violations of the ceasefire agreement. And definitely what we are witnessing on the ground is that the Israeli regime is still trying desperately to impose the new realities and facts on the ground by, as you know, wiping out more residential squares, by destroying more farmlands, and, as you know, keeping Palestinian people near those areas under the heavy bombings and the ongoing attacks. So this is very precarious for the Palestinian people, as they are still living the same sentiment of the genocidal war. And this is why the Palestinian people are still vitrified.
The Hamas resistance movement says it has warned Gaza ceasefire mediators that Israel's ongoing violations of the truce deal can jeopardize its implementation. Hamas spokesperson Hassan Qasem said the Israeli forces continue to shift the yellow line on a daily basis as part of their gradual encroachment strategy. He warned that such actions undermine the core of the agreement and heighten tensions on the ground. Regarding the deployment of international forces to Gaza, Qasem said their mission must include separating Palestinian civilians from the Israeli army, which presses them with its daily attacks. He said the implementation of the second phase of the truce would be a complex process, as Hamas has met all its obligations, but Israel continues its violations. Qasem said the presence of a Hamas delegation in Cairo reflects the movement's serious commitment to implementing the second phase of the truce. A Hamas delegation arrived in Cairo on Sunday to discuss the latest developments related to the ceasefire deal and review the outlines of its second phase with the mediators. Israeli forces and settlers press ahead with the violent raids on Palestinian towns and villages across the occupied West Bank, causing more casualties and property damage. In one of the latest incidents, a young Palestinian man was killed during a raid on the village of Deir Jarir, east of Ramallah. According to the Palestinian Health Ministry, 20-year-old Barah Khairi Ali Mali was shot by Israeli soldiers live fire in the chest. Local sources reported that settlers stormed the village and assaulted residents and their homes, while Israeli forces provided protection for them. Since the start of the Gaza genocide, Israeli forces and settlers have intensified their attacks across the West Bank, including the occupied city of Al-Quds. According to Palestinian sources, more than 1,000 Palestinians have been killed and over 10,000 others injured in the West Bank since October 2023. Our West Bank correspondent Nick Ahmed joined us earlier with an update on the latest attacks against Palestinians by Israeli forces and settlers across the occupied territory. Let's see what she had to say.
This is the 20th Palestinian martyr that is being killed directly related either by settlers or by settler violence. The village of Deir Jarir have been suffering under relentless aggression from the Israeli settlers, and a little less than a month ago, Deir Jarir also have bidded farewell to a Palestinian young man, also 21 years old. Jihad Ajaj was killed by the Israeli settlers in the entrance of the village. So what happened is that the Israeli settlers attacked the village and started burning down properties and fields, attacking Palestinians. So the youth of the village have uprised to defend their land and to defend their families, not to have a horrific fate like being burned alive or being shot at by the Israeli settlers. And as soon as they started defending their land, the Israeli forces interfered immediately and started firing live ammunition indiscriminately. And this has led to the injury of the Palestinian late martyr Bara Khairi in the chest. And according to medical resources, Bara suffered multiple times of his heart and lungs.
With that, we come to the end of this bulletin. Thank you for listening. Take care and bye-bye for now.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners, brothers and sisters all across the world. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. The program is Viewpoints. I am Atta, the host of this program. Tomorrow is Jamadi al-Sani III, the martyrdom anniversary of Lady Fatima al-Zahra. So that's why today's episode of the program Viewpoints is dedicated to the holy status of Lady Fatima al-Zahra in Islam and how women today can benefit from her teachings. For this purpose, I've invited two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sister Zainab and Shaykh Hussein. Sister Zainab, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam, brother, and to all the listeners.
And Shaykh Hussein, assalamu alaikum to you.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
All right. First, historically speaking, so many women have been mentioned as holy figures in the history of religions. There are also some examples mentioned in the Holy Quran. In the Shia theology and ideology, the status of Lady Fatima al-Zahra, the respected daughter of Prophet Muhammad, also the wife of Imam Ali alayhi salam, is considered really, really high. Mm. She is considered as a heavenly lady, a lady who had a role both in safeguarding the religion of Islam and safeguarding the successorship of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Now, historically speaking, can you give us some details about the importance and the significance of this lady in Islam first, Sheikh Hussein?
Yes, it's a good question to start. Actually, the status and position of Lady Fatima al-Zahra in Islam in general and also in Shia in particular, as you said, is a unique one.
Yes.
In terms of the role that she had from the early days of Islam. We see her in the sometimes even in the battles in the background, helping and participating in the like, for example, the injuries and the wounded soldiers, taking care of them,
nursing as a nurse.
Yes,
that's right. Okay.
Yes, and also the Prophet himself. There is this saying from the Prophet of Islam, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, said that fidaha abuha or Ummu Abiha, Fatima took care of me like the way a mother takes care of her child.
A mother of the father.
The mother of the father, in this sense. So, and also the level of respect that the Prophet showed to Fatima, salamullah alayha.
Yes.
Especially then, and I would say even now, is unique because people then would not expect a man to show such a level of respect to
a lady.
His own daughter. Like at that time, women, ladies did not have such social status. You stand up in front of them, especially if it is your own daughter. So, but the Prophet wanted to show people, it has different reasons. One of them was that he wanted to show them that this is a different daughter, this is a different personality, and also to tell them that the status of women in general is not what you think.
Even I've heard before her birth, there were some divine guidance for both Prophet Muhammad and Lady Khadija before the delivery of the child. So that's why I think that her life was short, you know.
Yes.
From 18 to 23, it's documented, not more than that, okay? But this short life of a lady had great impact up to today, you know. The mother of the imams, she is called, and this is really a high status considered for Lady Fatima al-Zahra. So, Sister Zainab, what was your first encounter with Lady Fatima al-Zahra when you knew her? I mean, how did you find her? How did you find her position in Islam?
Probably it would have been when I was reading about the Holy Prophet himself, because from that, there immediately came the love for the whole Ahlul Bayt, and obviously then especially for his daughter. But I was thinking about her, and I think especially, well, not just for us as Shia, I think the status she has for us Shia is so obvious in a sense. But I was thinking especially for people who are obviously outside of Islam. I'm thinking about women who are outside of Islam who have nothing like this. They have no role models like this. And I was thinking, this is it's so striking, some of the things she did, because I was just thinking today, you know, she was obviously when Imam Ali did not get successorship because he was busy preparing and then burying the Holy Prophet, and obviously successorship was done separately, we know.
Okay.
And she, even though she would have been also coming to the stage of being sort of early pregnant and then quite heavily pregnant, obviously before her martyrdom, she was going around and complaining about this and demanding justice for her husband. And this is something that even nowadays, for example, outside of the Islamic world, people will, and I've heard these comments that, oh, a pregnant woman is not capable of working properly. There's something, so in the Western mentality, non-Muslim mentality, is still this thing, A, about women, that women cannot have that sort of status, they're not as rational, they're not as intellectual, they don't have the same capacity. And this is why the Western feminism thing came in. You know, they didn't have Islam, so what could they do? But then, obviously, to think of a woman who is pregnant and who is carrying out all these very public duties, so that's just something that occurred to me today.
And that's it. So many ladies nowadays are, after their voices being heard all around the world, her famous sermons on that time, okay? When you look at the diction, when you look at the, we can say, literary level of these sayings and the sermons in the Arabic language, you find it really astonishing, okay? How a young lady on that time, maybe 18, maybe younger than that, okay, the mother of three children, can give such a lecture, such sermons, you know, at the times that, for instance, Prophet Muhammad is alone or Imam Ali is alone, okay? So this has been really astonishing, Sheikh Hussein.
Yes, true. Especially the sermon of Fadakiya, which has actually been documented not by Shia only.
Yes.
There is this book, Balaghat al-Nisa, the eloquent sermons of ladies.
Very good.
And in that, it has been documented. Also, other chains of narration. It's one authentic historical account that Lady Fatima al-Zahra delivered this sermon in the masjid. And beside the Arabic eloquence, like the depth of the teachings that are there, we're talking about Arabian Peninsula at that time.
Yes.
Women education is something close to taboo before Islam and after Islam. You're astonished how they got time to learn this thing. Like, they were constantly, I was talking about the support that she showed to her father throughout the years of prophethood. And they're not easy things. Like, those years, there were very difficult moments that normally people in the household, for example, they would raise some concern, they would protest, what kind of life is it that you have created for me? But then you don't see anything of this sort from Lady Fatima al-Zahra. Not only that, she shows full support. And sometimes when You see that not the Prophet, but maybe people around the Prophet, they start to break. She starts like encouraging them and telling them, no, this is something that we should continue. Mm-hmm. So we should not look at the moment that Islam is established. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about when Islam is starting early and nobody is there to help this seed growing. And then Lady Fatima al-Zahra starts his role from there and is pretty young at that time. And then the role that the sister said about her support for the successorship of Imam Ali al-Islam, this is very important because I think this is relevant to the situation that we have sometimes in political matters, is that people at that time, they had this, I mean, those people who wanted Imam Ali to be the successor, because we had some of them, a few of them. So they had this strong belief that it's hopeless, like there is no use. They have done what they have done. We cannot change it. Okay, because the majority of them, they were the elite of Quraysh at that time. They had some great things against Imam Ali alayhi salam because of the battles and everything. So they had this mentality that what would be the use if we start telling things? But then Lady Fatima al-Zahra teaches us that in moments like this in history, if you remain silent and you don't raise your voice, people in later generations would have confusion and misunderstanding. Maybe this was something normal. Everybody accepted. But then she wanted to leave a stance in history that, no, this was not normal. Okay. Maybe I cannot change it now, but I want the later generations to know that this was not something that the Prophet wanted. This is very important. Now, if, for example, some people would say, what can we do for Gaza? We cannot do anything. We're hopeless. But then raising your voice and leaving a stance in history that, no, think about some generations after us, when they look back in history, if they don't see any protest, if they don't see any voice raised against this situation, they would say, okay, maybe it was something normal. Maybe it was not as bad as other people claim. But if you leave a stance in history, at least it has this function that the truth and justice will not be forgotten after generations in folds of history.
Okay, and this is really important, highlighted part of the life of Lady Fatima al-Zahra.
IRIB English Radio. Please follow our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir.
And we know that sometimes we see that, for example, maybe the line of imamat or successorship to Prophet Muhammad up to now, up to Hazrat Hujjah, we can say is safeguarded because of maybe this and that, or because of this holy war or that holy war, or because of the presence of figures like imams who were men, okay? And we forget absolutely the role of a lady over here, okay?
This is the status of motherhood.
The motherhood.
When we talk about motherhood, it's not just biologically speaking. This is ideologically speaking. She safeguarded the role of the imams. And this is, it has some spiritual connotation in it, that ancient spiritual tradition, the role of the Lady Fatima al-Zahra, Laylatul Qadr.
The secret to Laylatul Qadr is Lady Fatima al-Zahra.
Because
Laylatul
Qadr was the vessel through which Quran was revealed to humanity, and Lady Fatima al-Zahra was the means through which the imams were given to humanity.
Okay, and a nice comparison have been made, an analysis between Laylatul Qadr and Lady Fatima al-Zahra. We do not understand what is Laylatul Qadr, as we do not know today where is the holy grave of Lady Fatima al-Zahra. And this has always been, a matter of concern for so many people. That's it. So, Sister Zainab, when we get to today's world, I mean, so many ladies might ask, okay, how to benefit from her character? In what aspects today's Muslims, especially a Muslima, can benefit from the teachings of Lady Fatima al-Zahra?
Well, I think maybe the first thing, and maybe, I don't know whether it's the most important one, but that is, especially nowadays, because we know that even all this, the Muslim women, all the Shia women, everyone is to some extent influenced by what they see outside of the Islamic world, what they see in media.
Yeah.
And maybe they start to think that, oh, the value of women is greater elsewhere. Uh-huh. There's just this sort of strange thinking, oh, the grass is always greener somewhere else.
Yes.
It usually isn't, because I've also heard that the grass is greener where you water it, mm-hmm. basically. But the really important thing, I think, for the women is to remember obviously the lofty status. And one of the aspects of this is that you always have to remember the lineage of the imams uh-huh. comes through a woman.
All
and
right.
this goes totally against anything that came before the advent of Islam, obviously in the Arabian Peninsula. Goes totally against the idea in the Western world, because lineage is always through the son, the oldest son, basically.
Uh-huh.
And here we have this very groundbreaking rule. This is the foundation that's established there. And then the other aspect, which is really important for the women to remember, is that, you know, typically we women are supposed to look at role models. Okay, so we look to this person to, you know, how we're supposed to behave as mothers, as wives, just as women in society.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, they give us a role model as a lady role model. But this lady role model is a role model not just for women, but for the men.
For the men too, that's
men
right.
Men also look to Hazrat Fatima Zahra.
Yes.
So that is how important she is.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really, so it's especially a sort of a, let's say, an intellectual understanding
mm-hmm.
of how elevated the status of a woman is. But we just find that in Islam, and particularly in the understanding in Shia Islam, of mm-hmm. course.
That's right. Okay. So, religiously speaking, when we look at her legacy, what do we find, which is with us today? For example, Tasbihat of Hazrat Fatima Zahra, which is recited, you know, after Salat by the Shias, is one of them. What else do we have, religiously speaking?
Yes, there are narrations from Lady Fatima Zahra.
Okay.
And the sermon, Fadaki, that I said, is studied in Hawzat al-Amiyya, both in terms of the Arabic eloquence uh-huh. and also some lines of it are very deep, like, for example, because it talks about the philosophy behind the religion.
So she was a hadith transmitter herself,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes,
okay.
yes.
Okay.
Actually, there are many, and also some of the things that she narrated
uh-huh.
is with the imam of the time. It is Sahih Mus'haf Fatima, which is a secret thing that the A'imma would refer to in order to get their knowledge from.
Okay, this is a kind of book of secrets or something like that?
It's a kind of teachings.
Teachings.
We believe that
that's
it is the interpretation of the Holy Qur'an.
Holy Qur'an, that's right.
Because in the Holy Qur'an, you have ambiguous verses, mutashabahat,
mm-hmm.
and Qur'an itself says, الرَّاسِخُونَ فِي الْأَلْمُ only know
mm-hmm.
the interpretation, true interpretation of them. So she has that role there. The other thing that I want to say is the nowadays we hear a lot about the women agency, like
mm-hmm.
We should empower women to have agency and stuff like that. But what we see in reality is that our girls, the members of our ladies in our communities,
all right.
It's not when the Western world talks about women agency, it's actually the influence of the media,
mm-hmm.
of the movies, of the lifestyle that they
yes.
want these ladies to follow. It's not agency.
It is weakening them rather than empowering
yes,
them.
Yes,
okay.
Putting
That's
them
right.
in a constant competition
yes.
of beauty and everything.
Yes.
So they actually lose their agency. But we see women agency in the life of Lady Fatima Zahra when everybody, almost everyone, was against her.
Mm-hmm.
But when she realized that something is true
mm-hmm.
and correct, she did it. This
All right.
is women agency.
With dignity and observing chastity. I
yes,
mean,
yes.
This is important.
Yes.
That's right.
So women agency is not in sexualizing, exposing
yes.
herself. No, no. Women agency is to make a stance and leave track in history
mm-hmm.
and becoming a role model. This is called women agency,
Very
not
good.
That we see nowadays here and there.
That's
and
right.
this is something that I think ladies in our communities should learn, that yes, sometimes, for example, you feel a lot of pressure. For example, to put hijab on.
Mm-hmm.
And there are lots of like gossiping here and there, people telling, making comments, toxic comments here
mm-hmm.
and there. You should not lose your agency. If you realize that this is something that pleases Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, then you should do it, regardless of what people say.
That's
this
right.
is the lesson that we take from the life of Lady Fatima Zahra.
Okay, that's it. So the names Zahra and Fatima are the most popular names of the girls selected every year, not only by Shias, but also non-Shias.
hospitals all across the world as the name of Muhammad and Ali are. And the case is that she is still remembered here and there, even among the Sunni brethren. Lady Fatima Zahra has such a great status, you know, when referring to her and the incidents that took place, you know, the son that she missed, Hazrat Muhsin, okay?
Yeah,
so, and still remembered in both literature, art, and the legacy of this holy lady is still very much awakening among all the Muslims all across the world. All right. Anything missed, Sister Zainab?
Yeah, I just add that, because I was just thinking, who are some of the people who, when I listen to them, when I watch them, somehow seem to be inspired by Sghata Fatima Zahra? And I was just remembering when I hear some of the speeches and I watch some of the ladies, so the wives of the martyrs, the daughters of martyrs, for example, I've really witnessed that inspiration from her.
All right.
So just coming through. So she is definitely, in a sense, her spirit, her status is very much alive in these women.
That's right. Okay. The late Sheikh Azizullah Attarodi has a series of the books. One of them is Musnad Fatima Zahra, okay? A complete biographical, historical look at the lives of the infallibles, including Lady Fatima Zahra. So that's a complete book. Our dear listeners can refer to that book in order to be more familiar with this whole lady. But thank you very much, Sheikh Hussain and Sister Zainab, for a nice elaboration. Again, we express our condolences for Jamadi Uthani III, the martyrdom anniversary of Lady Fatima Zahra, and we express our condolences to all dear listeners, Muslims, especially ladies all across the world. Thank you very much for being with us with the program Viewpoints. If you have any question, if you want to visit more about our other programs, please visit our website at iranradio.ir. To another episode, God bless you all. Do not forget us in your supplications and du'as. Fi amanallah.
IRIB English Radio. Please follow our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir.
And the dark night lights up as you praise God. Your tears rain on your hijab and this cold air is filled with the fragrance of jasmine flower. Come and walk again in our troubled streets and lanes, and heal the scars of our city with your sense of heaven. Oh, Fatima. Your door, and you give him your necklace and the only food in your home. You talk to God until the rising of the sun, and you forget yourself while praying for everyone. Come and walk again in our troubled streets and lanes, and heal the scars of our city with your sense of heaven. Oh, Fatima.
Destinies are written.
The month of no food and water.
We watch the weight of Islam tilt as demolished are its pillars. I watch the killer of Marhab and the conqueror of Khaybar struck on the head, and watching this reminds me of Ali al-Akbar.
A strike from which the heaven shook descends a book, a sensible.
Akbar like him would look.
My morning is never ending. Which is my eyes always waiting. Whenever one Ashura ends, another is just beginning.
The year is spread through our beard, but bends to east, the west, trying to comfort broken prayer.
detention and refugee centers in Samos suffer from severe overcrowding, where many refugees and migrants are detained for long periods, creating inhumane conditions. These individuals often face difficulty in accessing basic health care, psychological care, and adequate food. Before the establishment of the new camp or detention center on the Greek island of Samos, the situation for refugees there was extremely difficult. They lived in harsh conditions in the old camp near the town of Vathi, which suffered from severe overcrowding. The old camp was originally designed to accommodate around 650 people, but at times housed more than 7,000 refugees. Many refugees were forced to live in inadequate tents in the areas surrounding the camp, adding to their suffering. Additionally, there was a shortage of clean drinking water and sanitation, leading to the spread of diseases. Other challenges included long queues for food with insufficient rations, a lack of healthcare services, leaving refugees with untreated medical issues. Frequent violence and clashes, both among refugees and between them and the police. Weak protection for women and children, with reports of harassment and even assaults. Extremely long waiting periods, sometimes lasting years, before receiving decisions on asylum applications. This delay increased frustration and made life in the camp even more difficult. What happened next? The new closed camp was opened in September 2021, offering better infrastructure, but operating under strict surveillance, similar to detention centers. This has sparked widespread controversy among human rights organizations.
The volume of the need for health medical consultation is really high, because it's not just a population that is stable in a camp, it's a population that is turning, the turnover is very high. You've got hundreds of people leaving every month, being transferred to another camp, and then hundreds of people arriving and in need of new consultation. So we have a team of doctors, and we try to provide those consultation, but we also have limited capacity. And ultimately, there is a state responsibility to provide medical care to those people. It's a state's responsibility, but it's also a responsibility that comes from the EU and the European leaders. So that is really a one main challenge, the volume and the need for primary health care. Another challenge is also the referral in case of specialized care. On some islands, there is no access to some specialized care. There is no psychiatric care, for example, or there is no access to certain infectious disease treatments such as HIV, tuberculosis, or hepatitis. That means that when we identify someone that is in need for specialized care that is not available on the island, then we have to liaise with the authority to organize a timely transfer so the person can actually receive the care needed. And this also can be sometimes a little bit complicated.
In 2024 in Samos, we assisted more than 2,400 people arriving, and we have witnessed stressful and very distress as the arriving of the people. Psychological and medical issues mainly resulting from their severe experiences during their journey, but also as well pregnant women who need of emergency medical care.
Number of administrative challenges, but they're faced mostly, or our patients face a number of administrative challenges, and therefore indirectly when trying to provide them or trying to support them to receiving medical care, then we are also faced with those challenges. It really often comes to bureaucratic barriers, difficulty to register someone, or legal barriers as well. In terms of access, we've had challenges in the past, absolutely. It's been actually better recently. No one has a crystal ball to say what the future holds, really. I think we need hope in whatever situation. And I also think that actually hope, as I was saying earlier, the instinct for life actually is very, very strong, and it's part of the human nature. But I think we need to be under no illusion, because when you look at the already with actually numbers that are not that high, when you look at how the system is overwhelmed and struggling to actually uphold with the basic assistance and services that people need, and then you look at the broader international context at the moment with the an increased restrictive frame for migration in general, you have a rise of anti-migrant narratives all over the world. So I think we also need to hope for the best, but prepare for the worst.
Many young people and families from Arab countries seek refuge in Europe due to wars, poverty, repression, and political instability in Middle Eastern countries caused by Israeli colonization in Palestine, supported by the United States and the European Union. Israel's occupation has extended to encroach on neighboring countries like Syria, Lebanon, and Jordan, which poses a real threat to these countries, delaying their economic and developmental progress. This spreads poverty and unemployment, pushing young people to migrate to support their families. These migrants attempt to reach Europe via the Mediterranean Sea, a perilous journey. Unfortunately, this situation results in the loss of many lives and reflects the extent of desperation felt by these migrants under the current conditions.
أسباب اللجوء الأولى يعني هي مواضيع الحرب. الحرب والدمار اللي شافوه اللي شاف أهله.
The main reasons for seeking asylum often stem from wars, as refugees witness destruction and tragedies firsthand. When someone sees their loved ones dying in front of them and can do nothing to save them, their only option is to seek refuge elsewhere, where they can receive financial support and shelter. Many people live in tents, as we have recently seen when the winds blew them away, leaving families exposed and increasing their suffering. The situation of Palestinian refugees in Lebanon is very similar to that of Syrian refugees. They need residency permits that last for 6 or 7 months, sometimes up to a year, and often their applications get rejected in the end. If accepted, they receive a travel permit within 20 days to a month and a half, after which they rely on God and continue their journey, even if it means facing great risks. As for the journey across the sea, it is an experience filled with death and danger. I have gone through it twice. The first time was in 2015, when we stayed at sea for 7 hours. I also tried to travel through Libya, but the attempt failed. In another attempt, we spent 72 hours at sea and saw death with our own eyes. There were 107 of us on board, and the suffering is indescribable. Only those who have lived through it can truly understand the tragedy.
Palestinians, scattered across the world, often express their love for Palestine by saying they carry their homeland in their hearts, not in their passports. Every camp, every city, every distant street is only temporary until they return. When asked about their dreams, they answer without hesitation, to return.
I am from the city of Aled. My mother is from Tulkarem, and my father was among those displaced following the massacre that took place in Lida in 1948. The Lida massacre is one of the most horrific crimes ever committed. For the Zionist militias, it was essential to take control of the Palestinian airport and railway system in order to establish their entity. They turned those infrastructures into Israeli institutions, aided by militias that came from all across Europe. These facts are not forgotten. In 2021, just before the Dignity Uprising and the Sword of Jerusalem battle, I was watching a short documentary about Lida. It's hard to find much information about the city, and as I grew older, I started to search for the meaning of Lida. I found very little, especially about the massacre. Even though the Israeli Supreme Court released many documents related to various massacres, the Lida massacre remained shrouded in secrecy, which indicates the sheer horror of what happened there. Among the things I watched was a film about a group of Palestinian children in Lida who didn't speak Arabic and didn't know what Palestine was. It clearly showed the extent of the Israelization of the city and how Palestinian identity was being systematically erased. That day, I cried deeply. I felt there might be hope for some Palestinians in Nablus or Haifa to return. But for us, the people of Lida, there was no hope. Just 2 weeks later, the Sword of Jerusalem battle erupted. On May 10th, 2021, Lida became the first Palestinian city within the 1948 borders to rise up and liberate itself for 3 days, along with Acre and Beersheba. At that time, the settlers fled in terror, almost naked, from their homes. As a Palestinian from Lida, I say, every Palestinian has a story, and I belong to the third generation, my grandfather, my father, and now me. Ours is the generation that was meant to forget Palestine, but I was part of the generation that saw Lida rise again, even if only for 3 days. I witnessed the flood with my own eyes, and I saw how people in exile, whether in America or Amman, speak of return.
I am a Palestinian refugee, and the right of return is not just a slogan to me. It is a promise that does not expire. My grandparents were forced to leave their homes, but the keys to our houses are still in our hands, and our hearts remain tied to that land. Palestine is not just a memory. It is a future we strive for every day. We will return, because in our souls we never truly left.
One of the most heartbreaking scenes in the Gaza War occurred during the temporary truce, when refugees began returning from the south to northern Gaza. They were not walking toward their homes. They were walking toward a dream. Nothing awaited them there but rubble, and there was no guarantee the skies would remain calm. Still, they returned.
I painted a scene when the people of Gaza returned from the south to the north, a majestic sight, the sea to their left, destruction to their right, and they were walking toward their homes. It was the first time I had ever witnessed a Palestinian return. It was then that I realized the whole world does not want the Palestinian to return, and that the Palestinian is the only one who does. I came to understand that the Palestine we will return